This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
We've got the latest on trade policy with China, the debt ceiling, and, oh yeah, Facebook. So much for a sleepy Monday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 4th of October. Good to have you with us. If you tried to log on to Facebook or Instagram or WhatsApp today, well, you know what I'm about to say. Facebook's whole suite of apps went down just before noon Eastern time and stayed down for hours, no doubt boosting productivity for millions of otherwise distracted workers. It's not clear yet what caused the outage, but Marketplace's Molly Wood has been watching all this closely and joins me now. Hi, Molly.
Hey, Amy.
So what could cause an outage this big?
Yeah, I mean, it is hard to overstate how big a deal this is, which I know we will continue to discuss. It seems to have been some sort of internal configuration error of some sort. Now, I'm going to dramatically simplify, but what basically happened to Facebook is it's sort of like if you deleted my home address from Google and Google Maps, and then all of a sudden, you know, I ordered 10,000 pizzas on DoorDash, right? These drivers would just look around the neighborhood trying to find my house, but there wouldn't be an address there. So that is essentially what happened. And it's at the moment that we're speaking still ongoing. There is no address for Facebook or Instagram, or in some cases, WhatsApp, for all of these, you know, global networks of internet servers to find.
Now, it's easy to joke about all of us being bored at work without being able to check Instagram. But for folks who, you know, don't use these apps and maybe didn't even notice this, what are the bigger impacts?
Yeah, it's a huge deal. I mean, we're talking about an outage that affects potentially billions of people, but also affects anybody who is selling a product on Marketplace, not our Marketplace, Facebook Marketplace.
Right.
Affects anyone who's whose small business, for example, only exists on Facebook. Maybe they're taking orders that they cannot now be taking. There are, you know, a huge global network of advertisers. You know, in 2015, Deloitte put out research on behalf of Facebook that calculated the company's global economic impact at $227 billion. That was 6 years ago and before a pandemic that put everybody else online. So it might not, you know, might be hundreds of millions of dollars lost for Facebook, but when you start to calculate the effects across the broader global economy, it turns out you realize Facebook is responsible for a ton of economic activity, and all of that's come to a halt too.
Of course, people find it suspicious that all this happened the day after whistleblower Frances Haugen went public yesterday with a scathing critique of the company for putting profit over safety. Is that anything more than a coincidence?
I mean, we have no way of knowing. And, you know, Facebook, it seems, is telling employees that it doesn't know what happened. It is 100% possible for this to have been a configuration error internally. Somebody could have made a mistake that just so happened to, for all intents and purposes, erase Facebook and Instagram and parts of WhatsApp from the internet. Obviously, there is a ton of speculation because the timing is weird.
Yeah, it's weird. And maybe it's just bad timing for the company. All right. Molly Wood is host of Marketplace Tech and other podcasts. Thank you so much, Molly.
Thanks, Amy.
On Wall Street, more down than up. We'll have details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. It's safe to say the trade relationship between the United States and China is still fraught. The two countries continue to impose tariffs on more than $400 billion worth of each other's goods every year. And in a speech today, U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai said China isn't living up to its Trump-era agreement to buy more U.S. goods. Tai said the U.S. plans to launch new trade talks with the country and would take all steps necessary to protect U.S. industries from unfair competition. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has details.
Ambassador Tai told an audience at the Center for Strategic and International Studies that the root of U.S.-China trade tensions was still very much in place.
In recent years, Beijing has doubled down on its state-centered economic system. It is increasingly clear that China's plans do not include meaningful reforms to address the concerns that have been shared by the United States and many other countries.
The next step, Tai said, is to press China to stick to the agreements it made under the Trump administration to, among other things, buy more U.S. goods. But she acknowledged that doesn't really deal with the main economic beef between the two countries, how China heavily subsidizes some industries, undermining foreign competitors. Michael Herson at Eurasia Group says the U.S. sees little prospect of China changing its ways.
The Biden administration doesn't think that there's that much to be gained in the short term with negotiations with China.
Ambassador Tai did say that given how much China pours into its own infrastructure and domestic industries, the Biden administration's focus is building competitiveness here in the U.S., specifically through building U.S. infrastructure and worker training, currently being considered in Congress. Tai also said the U.S. needed to work with allies to address concerns with China, but offered few details. Mary Lovely is with the Peterson Institute.
I really don't think we gained a lot of clarity on what U.S. engagement with China is going to look like in the long run, unfortunately.
That may be in part because so much about the U.S.-China relationship is so unpredictable. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This morning, President Biden once again called on Republicans in the Senate to stop blocking efforts to raise or suspend the debt ceiling. Because if Congress doesn't act, in around 2 weeks, the Treasury won't have enough money to pay all of its bills. And a reminder, this is spending Congress has already approved. So what could the Federal Reserve do if the government defaults? Turns out there's a playbook for this, because Congress has come close to defaulting before. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
Fed officials have contemplated the possibility of default before. On October 16, 2013, the Fed governors, including Jerome Powell, who was not yet the chair, gathered at their D.C. headquarters. Economist William English, a senior Fed advisor at the time, was briefing them in Fed speak.
The committee could, if it chose, engage in either outright purchases or QSIP swaps.
Translation, the Fed could buy defaulted treasuries, U.S. bonds Treasury missed a payment on because it was running out of money, or swap Treasury bonds that weren't in default for those that were. At the time, Powell called those options loathsome. English, who now teaches finance at Yale, can see why.
Clearly, both of those steps would be stepping into the middle of a political dogfight.
And the Fed is supposed to be politically independent. Other pages in its default playbook include letting banks use defaulted Treasury bonds as collateral for short-term loans. Columbia Law Professor Catherine Judge says the idea is to keep financial markets calm.
And so part of it is just reducing the amount of uncertainty, any effort to dash for cash.
But the Fed can only do so much. Former Fed economist Ann Owen says it's kind of like bailing out a leaky boat.
But to address a fundamental structural problem in how we're financing our government is not something the Fed can do.
Fed Chair Powell told a congressional hearing last week, hey, don't look at me to solve your problems.
If there were to be a default on our obligations, no one should assume that the Fed or anyone else can fully shield the American people from the consequences of that.
Fed officials won't say if they're having contingency meetings this time around to review that default playbook. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Over the weekend, stories started breaking about a trove of leaked financial documents known as the Pandora Papers. The leak has exposed the offshore tax havens and hidden riches of billionaires and former world leaders and how they use the global financial system to their advantage. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists obtained the confidential files, and more than 600 journalists from 150 news outlets spent 2 years sifting through them. We got one of those journalists on the phone this afternoon. Dominic Rush is U.S. business editor for The Guardian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here.
So there's obviously a lot in these documents, and I know we'll continue to learn more in the coming days. But I wanted to focus with you on what we've learned about the U.S. financial system, because usually when we think of offshore tax havens, you know, the U.S. doesn't come to mind.
Yeah, like you say, I mean, there's an awful lot in here, and there's going to be more in the days to come. But I think one of the early revelations is what a central part the US is playing in what we're going to call offshore, but seems a bit odd as I'm talking to you from New York. One of the pieces we did today was about South Dakota, which has kind of emerged as the go-to place for the richest people in the world who are moving their cash there because it has better protections than many of the other places we think of as being traditional havens for offshore money like the Cayman Islands or even Switzerland.
Yeah, you talk about this whole trust industry that has emerged quite rapidly in South Dakota. How do these trusts work?
Well, I mean, it's amazing how much money they've got now. I mean, they've got about $367 billion in 2020, and they had $75 billion in 2011. And you can directly tie that to the kind of easing of restrictions on these trusts. So one example is, you know, our partners at the Washington Post had a story today about a divorcee who was struggling to get money from his ex because the money she had in trust, he could no longer get access to. And there are all these kind of rules have been brought in that protect the money above the interests of people who might sue or, you know, creditors from other countries, etc. And they've just brought in more and more legislation that has kind of made these trusts ever more powerful.
Now, if this isn't illegal, what's the problem?
Well, there's real world consequences here. I mean, you know, Kamala Harris, her first foreign trip was she was in Latin America, where she was lecturing people, leaders there, about corruption and about, you know, the need for transparency. Well, you know, at the same time, the US has now become, you know, the haven for the global elite. You know, this is money that could probably have been taxed in its origin countries, you know, Colombia or Dominican Republic, countries that certainly could do with boosting their tax revenues. You know, there are real world consequences to people from the tax revenues, and then there are sort of geopolitical consequences from America establishing itself as this, strange to say again, offshore tax haven.
The last time there was a massive leak of documents like this, known as the Panama Papers, some top government officials resigned. Regulators were promising a lot of changes. Why do you think we're here again?
Well, I mean, in part, it's because we only ever seem to find these things out when there is an enormous data dump like this. I mean, this is a huge data dump. I mean, it's 2.94 terabytes. So that's Netflix in HD for 24 hours, 7 days a week for 41 days.
Wow.
You know, this is obviously a debate that I think people are having around the world about how the global elite basically live by an entirely different set of rules. I mean, we can kind of know that in theory, but these kind of leaks show it in practice and show how much money is being kind of hidden away from taxmen across the world.
Dominic Rush, one of, what, hundreds of journalists sorting through all those terabytes of documents. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up,
the rents increase with the demand.
And a lot could go wrong with that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 323 points, 0.9%, to finish at 34,002. The Nasdaq slashed off 311 points, 0.2%, to end at 14,255. And the S&P 500 fell 56 points, about 0.3%, to land at 4,300. As we mentioned on the tech front, widespread outages for many users today of Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp. Facebook disengaged 4.8%. And overall, investors unplugged from tech stocks. Google's parent company Alphabet and Apple were both down more than 2%. A major oil spill off California's Orange County coastline over the weekend has fouled some beaches there. Amplify Energy owns the pipeline where the suspected leak occurred. Amplify slid down more than 43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. If you've taken an Uber or a Lyft lately, you've probably noticed the higher prices. Wall Street has been paying attention, too. Lyft recently reported its first profitable quarter, and Uber expects to do the same soon. Fares have continued to rise as the companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars to attract drivers who defected during the pandemic. A new analysis from investment advisory firm Gordon Haskett shows those price increases come at a cost. Public data from New York and Chicago suggests the rideshare companies are ceding ground to an old rival, taxis. Yeah, remember them? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Philadelphia musician Mike Bishop was looking for the best way to get to the Eagles football game Sunday. Parking's too big of a pain, weekend transit too slow, and Uber and Lyft rides were running about $40. Then he remembered something he saw about an app for taxis called Curb.
So I gave that a shot and it ended up being about half the price and works just the same.
Bishop says he's a millennial who hasn't called a cab since before the dawn of rideshare apps.
And the cab driver had like the old credit card thing you had to like slide over and make a carbon copy of. Like it was really old school.
Now what's old school is new again.
Taxis have had a second wind.
Joe Schwederman at DePaul University says the taxi industry has become more Uber-like with apps to hail and pay for rides. And now prices are competitive.
So we're going to see the two sectors continue to kind of blend into one, I think.
But it's not just about the app. Those high surge prices that are sending people to taxis are what make rideshare apps successful, says NYU business professor Arun Sundarajan.
Having this continuously varying price through the day even if it makes some consumers uncomfortable, actually leads to a dramatically better service.
Surge pricing can attract more drivers during busy times, so users don't have to wait as long to find a ride. Taxis, however, are usually limited by local governments. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
It's been a little over a month since the Supreme Court blocked a nationwide eviction moratorium from the CDC. And although we have yet to see the surge of evictions many had feared, some communities are seeing an increase in filings. One such place is North Charleston, South Carolina, which before the pandemic was reported to have the highest eviction rate in the country. The eviction lab at Princeton University found that in 2016, more than 16% of all tenancies in North Charleston ended in eviction. We got Nicole Paluzzi on the line. She's the housing attorney for Charleston Pro Bono. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
North Charleston was number one for evictions before the pandemic. What were some of the causes?
Well, a lot of the causes can be related to income inequality, rent burden, which is when a family is paying more than 30% of their household income towards housing expenses monthly. Another cause is that there are issues with wages keeping up with those expanding rental rates. So we don't have any programs that stabilize rents like rent control in our area. So as more people are flocking to Charleston because it's a wonderful area to live, the rents increase with the demand, and people that are, you know, considered working poor, they become rent burdened and unable to afford those rental amounts, and then they get evicted for non-payment of rent.
So what are you seeing now without that federal protection in place? Are you seeing more evictions and more people actually being removed from their homes?
We actually are in our area. Now, I know there was an article recently saying that the tsunami was not seen in a number of metro areas, but in Charleston County, we see an influx of people demanding assistance with eviction defense. Our dockets have increased in size and volume. My most recent term of housing court actually had extra judges brought in so that they could increase the amount of cases that could be timely heard while providing those housing court resources to the tenants who are needing advocacy and support resources.
Now, there's all this money that's supposed to be preventing widespread evictions, right? Billions of dollars in federal emergency rental assistance. I understand that as of August, South Carolina had only distributed a fraction of the $272 million the state received. What are the hangups?
A lot of them are procedural burdens. Charleston County was large enough and had the infrastructure to be able to operate their own pot of emergency rental assistance payment money. And of that program, the people that are applying are not experiencing as many procedural burdens. But at the state level, there was a backlog because there was a need for the tenants to be able to provide the adequate documentation and application to the program. And when you're talking about persons who would need rental assistance, you're talking about a very low income demographic. So they don't have stable internet or access to a scanner. So they needed to first find the assistance, find the technical support, gather their evidence, upload those files. And then it created a bottleneck because all of the applications were coming in at the same time.
Typically, landlords and tenants both need to participate in that program to get the money. I'm wondering if you're seeing any reluctance on the part of landlords who may actually prefer to get a tenant out than get the money, the relief.
Unfortunately, yes, that is exactly what I've been seeing. We have a number of landlords who have come to court and stated that the relationship has become so strained between them and the tenant, or the tenant may be 5 months or more behind in rent, even though they have filed the application timely. We have landlords that refuse to believe that the tenant is acting in good faith. And just yesterday, I had a landlord who said the exact same thing. She did not care that the tenant was fully applied, had an approval. And we had a letter from the county emergency rental assistance program that said the only thing outstanding to cut the check was that the landlord had not logged in to create a W-9 profile with the county to receive those funds.
Given the widespread evictions before the pandemic, before the economic distress that it caused, what do you see as the solution here longer term in a place like North Charleston?
I think direct tenant assistance that doesn't require the landlord to sign off would be helpful. I see that as a failure of equity because the tenant is working towards a goal that's going to benefit both themselves and the landlord, which is good faith. And I see that these tenants are being delayed or frustrated and their tenancies are coming to an end because they can't get compliance out of a landlord. And if really they're not interested in receiving those funds, then they should not be filing actions for possession based on lack of payment of those funds.
Nicole Paluzzi is a housing attorney with Charleston Pro Bono. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Amy.
This final note on the way out today, because who doesn't need a boost? Captain Kirk is going to space. Yes, William Shatner is scheduled to be aboard the next Blue Origin launch. The second crewed flight of the company's new Shepard rocket is set for the morning of October 12th. If you're losing track of billionaire adventures in space, Blue Origin is the one owned by Jeff Bezos. Shatner, of Star Trek fame, is 90 years old and would be the oldest person to fly to space. Pretty cool. All right, here's your moment of economic context on this Monday. The restaurant comeback isn't as strong as many had hoped. Bloomberg reported today on a new survey showing that 51% of small restaurants couldn't pay their rent in September. That's up from 40% in July. And while customers are back, higher food prices and labor shortages are cutting into profits. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.